Well, there they are, the Tom Tom Club. And the Wordy Rapping Hood is their tune, circa 1983. And it is the name of this little wireless program that you've found yourself with your ears around on RPPFM. Tracy Hutchison here with you for this edition of the Wordy Rapping Hood, the program that has as its premise an opportunity to showcase and get to know the many folk who live and work and love life on the peninsula. And I'm very excited to say that today's guest ticks all of those boxes. Someone with a very long association and love of the Mornington Peninsula. He's a former Olympian, Australia 2 crew member, a mariner, farmer, sometime part-time co-host of Arts About here on RPPFM. Mr. Will Bayou, welcome to the studio, something that's probably quite familiar to you, but nice to see you in here.
Well, this is a lot warmer than the studio that I'm normally in, Tracy, but yeah, thanks for having me on. This is, you know, better than being invited by Philip Adams, I reckon, to come on the radio with you.
Big shoes. Thank you very much, Will. Will Bayou, first question of this program, and I thought it was timely too because we're on the eve of the Olympics. Of course, the opening ceremony is next Friday, and I do want to talk very much about your own experience as an Olympian at the 72 Munich Games. But let's kind of do a little bit of program association. And first question for this show is always, what brought you to the peninsula? So it's a big name on the peninsula, the Bayou name, but what brought you and your family here?
Well, I think we're one of the original sort of boat people families, because my great-grandfather jumped ship, literally dived overboard off a ship in 1853 at Portsea. At the quarantine station.
What was his task? What was he doing at that time?
Well, he was a professional seaman and he'd been around the world several times. He started as a 15-year-old. He was only 19 when he jumped overboard. And I think he got away, he swam across to the other side. He actually went out through the heads and came up at Point Lonsdale.
Wow, one of the original rip swimmers.
I think he's the first one to swim to swim the rip. So that's a long time ago.
Yes. And so that was the connection on that side. So how did it sort of morph?
Well, that's
over
the connection. He jumped in at Portsea, swam to Point Lonsdale. He hid out till the ship had gone. He ended up getting a job there as a lighthouse keeper, and he got married to a local girl. They built a little hut literally on the beach at Queenscliff inside the Bight there, just with whatever they could get together. And they had 16 children.
Right.
So very rabbit-like, the Bayou family. We spread out. And that's where we came from.
And so at some point there was a connection to this side of the bay, the Mornington Peninsula. So what are your earliest memories of your connections on this side?
Well, we did. The family kind of came back down to this side, and we had a family holiday house in Sorrento. So holidays, school holidays and things were spent down here. And my father got his love of the sea and fishing and boats from his father and obviously from his grandfather, who was the guy that swam ashore. And we were brought up fishing and catching sharks, rowing, boating. We had dinghies to get around, and we learned to sail. We became boatmen. We weren't racing sailors as such, but we knew how to handle a boat. And we were taught from a very young age. And swimming on the back beach, being taught how to swim in the surf, all that's part of it. Portsea Back Beach or the Sorrento Back Beach, mostly the Portsea Back Beach.
Will Bayou is our guest on the Wordy Rapping Hood on RPPFM, and we're enjoying the life and times of Will, which is very much linked to life on the peninsula and a love of the peninsula over a long period of time. Will, you were talking about those boyhood memories on the peninsula, holiday memories that many of us share. The water is a huge part of holiday life here on the peninsula. What are some of your favourite or most colourful boyhood memories of that time as a young tacker growing up with your brothers?
Well, I remember hiding when a time came to go back to Melbourne at the end of school holidays. They could never find me. I was always hiding, hoping I wouldn't have to go back. But I remember I think I was about 10 years old, being taken out by my uncle down just inside the Heads, Port Phillip Heads there, and going snorkeling and spearfishing. And he had his friend Harold Holt with him, who I think was the treasurer at that stage. And I've been amazed because I was quite handy with my snorkel and mask and spear gun as a 10-year-old. But watching this man go under and stay under for about 2 minutes, he could stay under the water for about 2 minutes.
This is Harold Holt, and I think one of the most famous photos of Harold Holt is actually him in his wetsuit and his flippers and his mask holding a fish that he very proudly speared off the back beach there. You were also on the beach, as I understand it, at that sort of infamous or famous moment at Cheviot Beach, the tragic moment where the then Prime Minister drowned.
I wasn't there when he went out swimming, but when the search was on, I nicked off from school with an older friend and he borrowed a car and we drove down to Portsea and stayed up there on the cliff watching the search go on. It was, you know, unbelievable.
So you were quite young though at that time.
I think I was about 16, yeah. 16, and my friend Jack was 18. He had his mother's car and we just shot down for the day and watched the proceedings. We were expecting them to find Harold Holt, but of course that never happened. Mm. So. Mm.
And the love of the being engaged with that sort of life would have really lasting impact on other decisions that you made. You were also rowing at the time, as I understand, at school, so that was sort of starting to happen. And then there was another quite colourful moment that happened for you down on that back beach with escorting a very famous singer into the back beach surf, which is just another extraordinary story of being somewhere with someone extraordinary at a really significant time.
Yeah, my sister Kate worked in Current Affairs and on the TV, and she met Nina Simone, and we all went to Nina Simone's Melbourne concert back in, I think, mid to late 70s. I can't remember exactly when. And she was a troubled woman and had a reputation for her depression and all kinds of stuff coming from her highly conscious memories of slavery and the whole thing that blighted America. Anyway, she stopped in the middle of the concert and walked off the stage, and everyone started to clap, not in a bad way. They were very encouraging. They wanted her to come back. And there was a call for my sister Kate, came over the PA. She had to go backstage and talk to Nina Simone. Apparently they'd struck up some kind of relationship. Anyway, it was only a few days. She came back and finished the concert and it was magnificent. It was just wonderful. A few days later, Kate rang me and said, would I come with her down to Portsea midweek, because she wanted to take someone swimming in the surf that had requested to go surfing. And I turned up down there and accompanied Nina Simone down onto the beach at Portsea, and we went into the surf and I was there to kind of look after her to make sure she didn't drown.
And how does she go in the back beach? She
was not
quite
a good swimmer. she was really interesting, hard to get a smile, but she did have a smile when she got knocked over by the first shore break. And my job was just to make sure if she went under, she didn't stay under. And she sank like a stone, basically. Mm. But yeah, it was just a great experience to meet Nina Simone, I guess when she was in her 50s probably, really at the absolute peak of her career.
Mm. And being, I guess, the person that was having a moment like that with a huge star, she was at that time and continued to be, I guess having a sort of a private kind of insight into her life, a very troubled woman. What did you read of her at that time, and having that, you know, one of those little precious moments where you're taking someone swimming and the joy of the water and perhaps sort of an opportunity for her to think about nothing else except getting bounced around in the wonderful surf.
I think that's why she wanted to go. And I think even though I was a youngster in my 20s, I recognised that because I knew about her reputation. I knew where she was coming from. Some of the songs like Strange Fruit, which she was well known for, were really about horrors that were existing inside her brain, about all the lynchings of black people in America. Mm. And I think that the request to go and enter the surf in Australia was, as you say, it was a way to just drop those walls. She had lots of walls up. I think she was mentally ill. Mm. She suffered depression, all kinds of... She was a troubled woman, but made beautiful music. And I've discovered in my life that's often the case, that the people with the you know, the biggest troubles make the sweetest sound when they do apply themselves to the arts.
You've selected a Nina Simone song, Will Bailey, for our first musical interlude, and I have I've got quite a lot of Nina Simone in my personal collection, but I didn't have the one we're about to hear, and I'm curious for you to tell me about why you love this version or Nina Simone's version of A New World Coming, and why you selected it today.
Well, it's kind of an optimistic song. And it's got a beautiful rhythm that kind of makes you float. It reminded me of actually being out in the surf. It floats along. And then in the middle of it, she really goes back to this God-fearing part where she talks about the wrath of God, and she narrates that in the middle of the song while it's going on behind her. It's dramatic. It's beautiful. I love listening to it. Even after all these years, I still listen to it. So
let's have a listen to Nina Simone on RPPFM. Nina Simone on Audible PFM, the song from Nina Simone, A New World Coming, and the selection of our guest here on the Wordy Rapping Hood, Will Bailey, on this Friday. Will, we had that song up very loud in the studio, yeah. And taken back to the 70s. Will Bailey, Olympian, Australia 2 crew member, mariner, and personal swimming instructor of Nina Simone. You were telling that story about escorting her into the back beach and transported back to a wonderful time in the 70s.
Oh, I know. I think we're both transported. Just great time for me particularly. You know, as a young man, you're sort of perfect at that age, and I was fit. I was an athlete. I was active. I was studying. Everything was going right. So what could be wrong with that song? It's a happy, positive song.
Indeed it is. We're going to stay in the 1970s, sort of late 60s, early 70s, and you were talking about your great affection and time that you spent sort of, you know, getting your water skills intact on the back beaches at down here on the peninsula. And at school, you were becoming something of a champion rower, and your life was going to take a very big turn leading up to the 1972 Munich Olympic Games. Just take us back to that.
Well, I was a swimmer at school to start with, but was very keen to start rowing because I loved rowing the dinghy, and you know, I was used to doing that. You could start rowing when you're 14, which is what I did, and gave up my swimming. I was quite a good swimmer, and I trained. I became a schoolboy champion in rowing. I loved the sport. It helped me through schoolwork. It was great discipline, working with a team, having aims and trying to squeeze the most out of yourself. It was just great training. I think it's a wonderful sport. It's poetic, and you support your own weight, but it's kind of brutal at the same time.
Mm. And more than that, you found yourself selected to represent Australia, and found yourself leaving Australia for the first time as part of the Australian 1972 Olympic team, the Munich Games. Your experience of being there also coincided with one of the darkest chapters in the Olympic movement, the now infamous Israeli hostage drama. Tell us your recollections. How do you recall, I guess, first the heady excitement of being part of the Australian team? So take us there, because we're preparing for that at the moment. Next week, the Olympics start. But your own recollections of 72.
Well, yeah, it was the first time I'd ever left the country. That was dramatic for me, just to arrive in Frankfurt on a flight and be in another country where they didn't speak English. I remember that feeling. We travelled around Europe. We competed. It was just heady. It was exciting. Munich was beautiful. It was warm. It was Bavarian summer. The city was, there were flags everywhere, but it was friendly, and you could get around everywhere by train. There was no security in the Olympic Village to speak of, really. We had tags we were supposed to wear, but half the time we forgot them, and you just talk to the guy on the gate and he'd let you in. I had all my friends who came over, various people from rowing, would just come in and have dinner with us in the village. We'd just talk them in. It was hard to get information. When this drama happened, we were called into a team meeting, and we were told there had been a drama. The details were fairly sketchy. No internet, no mobile phones back in those days. We still used to write letters to people by hand. So it was actually hard to find out what had happened. But it was quite close by to where we were. There were only one or two buildings away from our building in the village. And we did hear commotion, didn't know what it was about. I think, ironically, I didn't really know what had happened with the murdered Israeli athletes until about a month after the games, when I was down in the south of France and I was able to buy a Time magazine, an American English word magazine, and actually read the account of what happened. And that's the first time I really understood how it all knitted together.
So even being in the Olympic Village as an athlete and being part of those games, you weren't aware?
We knew, we were given information. We knew there had been hostage taking with the Israelis. We knew there had been shooting. We weren't really aware of the deaths at the airport that happened when they blew up the helicopter. Mm. We did see armed gunmen up on the roofs of various buildings. They were in tracksuits. They looked like anyone else in the village. They were armed German snipers, and there was even tanks, small armoured tanks outside the Olympic Village. I'm not sure what they were for, whether they were planning to sort of blow up a building, but everything was there, and there were an enormous number of police. So security was pretty tight then. You couldn't go in or out of the village for a couple of days.
Because there was a real, I think, global loss of innocence with that event. The coverage of it, certainly it sounds like those of us who were watching it knew more about it than those inside. And it's interesting, I imagine, for you even reflecting back on that time and imagining, you know, for example, athletes now as they prepare for the opening ceremony next week of a Games that has been already shrouded in controversy and very heavy security in a very, very different kind of Olympic era. What do you make of the whole Olympic movement now and I guess sort of from your own personal perspective, having been an Olympian, what would they be going through right now, do you think?
Well, look, I can remember writing a letter home a couple of days before the game started, and the thing that struck me most in the Olympic Village was this incredible feeling of this huge wave of energy, almost like a balloon that had been overinflated with 3,000 or 4,000 athletes in there ready to go, some of whom had been training for 10 years for that moment. And it was a huge wave of energy that was about to be unleashed. And I'm sure that's the same in every Olympics, and I think it will be in Rio as well. The security side of things has changed everything. There were exclusions in Munich. The South Africans were there, and as a result, a lot of the African nations elected not to go to Munich, which meant we missed out on a lot of their wonderful athletes. There had been a terrible massacre of students in Mexico before the Mexico Olympics by the police. They were protesting and a lot of them were killed, and people tend to forget that. There's been trouble since at Olympic Games, but somehow or other the game seems to override that. Mm. And the athletes themselves, once they get going, just take over, and it's another show which we'll all remember. I hope we do anyway.
Mm. Will Bayview is our guest on The Wordy Wrapping Hood here on RPP FM. Tracy Hutchison here with you, and we're weaving our way through the very colourful and event-filled life of Will Bayview, was representing Australia in the rowing in the 72 Olympics. How'd you go, incidentally?
We finished about middle of the field. There were lots of dramas. We actually had some deaths ourselves. We had three people die at different times. One in the four, the coxed four that I rode in.
Well, in the lead up to it.
Brian Denny was electrocuted. He was killed. And Zach McWhirter, who was the sixth man in the eight, he developed cancer, unfortunately, and he was not able to join us on the trip to Munich, and he died while we were actually away. Oh. And then just shortly after, two of the coaches, the coach for the eight and the coach for the four, both died. So it was a very tragic sort of a thing, and we did have disrupted preparation, but we were a pretty tight team and we did the best that we possibly could. And we went pretty fast, but maybe not fast enough.
So from 72, there's a pretty interesting period of time that leads 11 years later to you being part of the successful Australia 2 crew that win the America's Cup. Probably one of the most significant moments that put Australia on the global map for a whole range of reasons, but Alan Bond's big tilt for the cup. And how did you go from being in the rowing team, finishing kind of in a middling kind of way in the 72 games, to that extraordinary turn of events?
Well, they're connected, the two sports, in a way. I rowed on for a while. I went to live in Sydney. I rowed there for a while. I came back and represented Australia again in 1978. Then I kind of, 1980, I gave away the rowing because of various injuries that kept reoccurring. One of the people I was coaching for a while then, and one of the people I coached, his father, Barry Scott, was the president president of the Victorian Yachting Council, and I met him because I was coaching his son, and he said, you should be out ocean racing, and he gave me various introductions to people for blue water sailing, and so I did a little bit of that on Superstar with Keith Farfour and his crew. And then later on, he came and saw me another time down on the riverbank, and he said, "Are you going to go and sail in this America's Cup?" I said, "Well, I don't know. What? I wouldn't know how to do that. I'd love to do that because I'd been interested in America's Cup, since I was a little kid." Mm. And he said, "Well, would you be prepared to go and try out?" And I said, "Well, what can I do?" He said, "Well, you can sail, you can row, you can build boats," because I had been a boat builder at that stage. So. He organised a meeting for me with John Bertrand in Melbourne at his sail loft, at the North Sail Loft in St Kilda. And I spoke to John, and I then got a message inviting me to come over to Perth to try out, which I did. I went and spent a couple of weeks training and sailing on the newly launched Australia 2. I helped work with the boat builder who was putting together Challenge 12.
Keel.
Yeah, I saw that for the first time, and it was all covered up and shrouded, and we were told we weren't allowed to tell anyone. And
yes,
all that stuff.
It was quite the global secret.
Oh,
the
it was
keel.
Fantastic. I loved the whole idea. It was all backwards. Difficult boat to sail. We had to learn how to sail it. And then at the end of the 2 weeks, they said, "Righto, well, you can head off home. Here's your air ticket and we'll get back in touch." And I'd already made up my mind that if they sent me home, there was a chance they mightn't get me back. So I said, no, I'll stick around. And they said, "Well, actually, everyone leaves now and the next lot come in to try out." Uh-huh. I said, "Well, that's fine, but, I'm happy to stick around. I'll go and help out somewhere else." So I just stayed around. They couldn't get rid of me. I figured that was my best chance.
So take us then to, I guess, the immediate preparations and your own recollection of that incredible race, the day that our then Prime Minister declared, so famously that we all deserved a national holiday. You were there on the boat on Australia 2, the America's Cup, 1983. Tell us how you remember that.
Well, it's interesting because everyone does remember that last race, but it was one of about 100 races that we had to go through to get there. So we raced every day for 4 months or more in Newport, and we competed. We knocked off other boats. We gradually eliminated till we got to the final against the English. Then we beat them, and then we were selected to race America's Cup. And, of course, it was the best of seven races, so we had to get ourselves in a position to win that the final race to make it a 4-3, or you had to win at least four races. Mm. And so that final race, it was locked at 3-3. How that happened, I don't know. We had a couple of breakages, but we elected to just not do anything different to how we'd done it all summer. The breakages were taken care of. Everything was checked. And the final race, I was not on board. I sustained an injury, which was disappointing. I'd done everything else. But I was on the boat with Alan Bond and Warren Jones and Ben Lexon on the tender. And we went out and we were taking the telemetry, which was the information being fed back from the boat. And to watch that final race, it was just extraordinary. And Ben Lexon was kind of in a fetal position down below and didn't want to be disturbed. when we crossed in front on the second last leg, right down at the bottom of that leg under Spinnaker, and we actually got to the bottom mark ahead of the Americans who had been leading us at the previous mark. That's when I went down and woke Benny up, Ben Lexon. And he didn't believe what I was telling him. I said, you've got to come up, you've got to come up. So we all went up to the flying bridge. And of course, it was just mental, that last 45 or 50 tacks that we had to do up the last leg, which we had well under control, but everyone was looking up the whole time, wondering if anything was going to break. And the Americans ran us right off the course. We went out into the spectator fleet, but we continued to cover them. And it was just a dream come true to watch that beautiful little white boat just slide over the line and see the puff of smoke from Fox Hunter, I think was the name of the boat that I think that was the name of the New York Yacht Club boat where they fired the gun at the end of the race.
I think we all remember the footage quite indelibly, and your memories of it feel quite visceral in the recounting. Sometimes it's also only in retrospect that you really grasp, you know, particularly when you're in the middle of something as significant as that. And I guess as the years have rolled on, you know, it was a really significant era for Australia, the 80s. You know, we really did take a big step on the global map, and that was one of the events that did it. How do you kind of look back on that time in terms of how Australia was kind of, you know, raising its head to the world at that time?
Well, we had a new Prime Minister, a Labor Prime Minister in Bob Hawke. He was elected that year. He became a friend of the Australia 2 Syndicate, and he visited us in Newport a couple of times. And we had lots of other visitors as well. I think Alan Bond always used his America's Cup challenges to promote his business interests. And, of course, that was the year of WA Inc., Brian Burke, Premier, and there was Laurie Connell, the racing. There were lots of colourful identities, I think you'd call them, many of whom have since died. Some of them went to jail. It was an exciting era, but they were pushing Western Australia, and Bob Hawke was pushing Australia, and he latched on to that, and I think he did it quite well, you know, and he'd given up the grog, but he was covered in
so
grog that night. I think people were pouring it all over him. But look, it's one of those great things in folklore. And we were lucky enough to catch up with Bob Hawke again just a few years ago, a couple of years ago in Sydney for the 30th anniversary of that. Yeah, great performance.
Event.
Yeah, and he hasn't changed much. He was great.
We might come back and talk some more politics, because politics has also been a big part of the Bailiw family over the many years as well, Will Bailiw. But I think we have to, if we've been talking about the America's Cup, I think we've got to hear this. This was the soundtrack. This is Men at Work. This is Down Under on RPPFM. We're all transported back to the early 80s now. From Men at Work, and a song from them called Down Under, and a song forever synonymous with the good times, Australia winning the America's Cup, and one of the crewmen as part of that America's Cup winning crew on Australia 2, Will Bailiw, is with us, Olympian, 72 Olympics, mariner, boat builder, farmer.
Farmer, general hand,
general
available
hand.
For hire if anyone is listening and wants to hire someone.
General hand. We're going to have a message break in a moment, Will, and then come back and talk more about politics as well, how that's underscored much of the Bailiw story over the decades as well, and your own perspective on that. But there was something about hearing that song for both of us where it really was the beginning of a great Australian pride. I think it was the first time globally that Australians started feeling really proud of who we were and are as Australians, and songwriters were starting to write about it as well. Did you have a sense of that when you were part of an event like Australia 2 winning the America's Cup?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was part of our plan, actually, when we were over there as a
the
team.
The Vegemite song.
Is that we would just be Australians. We weren't trying to be Americans or trying to catch up with the Americans or the French or the Canadians or Italians, whoever we were racing. We were just going to be Australians. We wouldn't call each other guys. That was illegal. It was mate we call each other mates. Mm. We played Australian music. We rode Australian bikes. We wore gear that was, you know, made in Australia. We were full on Australians, mm. and we took pride in it. We figured that was a good psychological ploy. And that song really transports me back there. It always does.
Yes, yes. I can almost see the sea salt, you know, materialising.
Yeah, because they played it on the tender that used to tow us out to sea. It was about a four-hour tow to get out into where we were going to race. And that song would be played about 20 minutes before we left the dock, and that was the signal for everyone to get to the dock, whatever you were doing. We had to leave on time every time. It was part of our ploy, so...
And our guest on this Friday is Will Bailiw, 72 Olympian, crew member of the successful America's Cup winning boat, the Australia 2, boat builder, mariner, part-time, sometime presenter of Arts About here on Ardawar PFM Farmer. The question I guess I've got is what do you do when you've won the Australia Cup and you come back to Australia and you think, oh, well, that was good. What do we do now?
Well, it was a sad time because it was such a great journey, and we all felt sad when it finished, actually. And it was a bit of a letdown. We had a party, which wasn't a party, in Newport, and we sat around and kind of all just went to bed, and we figured, well, that's the end of that, and which was a little sad. But, you know, coming back to Australia, of course, people wanted to meet us and do all that stuff, and we realised then that we'd had a big impact at home that we had not really been conscious of while we were in our bubble over there in Newport, Rhode Island. Mm. But what I did was I found it a little hard in some ways to cope. I built another boat and then decided to kind of cut loose, pack up the dog and the ute and go up to far north Queensland and find something that I was good at up there. And I moved up there on and off for about 10 years and got involved in property development up there and, you know, did it my way at Bingle Bay, which was near Mission Beach, Dunk Island, up that way.
And what's your way when you say when you did it your way? What do you mean by that?
Well, it was the era of the White Shoe Brigade, and I wasn't a white shoe wearing type of guy. So I did things my way, which meant that we were going to do some really good development, which meant underdeveloping things and locking it up safely for all time so that it couldn't be chopped up into tiny little bits. And I've never regretted doing that. They proved popular, those properties up there. Mm. People can't see anyone else. They feel like they're the only person in the area. It's beautiful, and it's such beautiful country. Mm. It's in my blood up there.
And then another part of the world, another part of Australia that was in your blood eventually called you back, and you met a woman called Sally Martin, an old friend. You'd re-hooked up with her and she became Sally Bailiw, and you found your way back to the peninsula with the beginnings of your family in tow and started life back on the peninsula.
Well, I figured I was always going to go back to the peninsula because that's, you know, that's me, that's where I'm from. And yeah, we moved back. Sally and I got married in far north Queensland, and we decided to come back. There was work for Sally. She was a theatre producer and was keen to get back into work down there. I was happy to go back. I was going to build boats, do all kinds of stuff. Anyway, then we planned a family, and once we started having little babies, it was just a better place to be. So we moved to my little cottage down right on the end of the peninsula, and we brought up our little babies down there and did whatever we needed to do. I got back into the real estate business, you know, put on the shirt and tie.
And some semi-white shoes.
Yeah, almost.
Running through the Bailiw story, though, is politics. And at the beginning of the conversation, Will, you talked about the family friend in Harold Holt, who was treasurer at the time, and then you recalled being on the beach, scooting down to Melbourne, scooting down back to the back beach at the day that Harold Holt had gone missing on the back beach. And I'm just going to ask you briefly about that recollection, because he'd been a family friend. He'd been someone that you'd gone fishing with, and wasn't even someone that you really understood to be a politician particularly. That must have been a very pivotal moment at the point where Australia had lost a prime minister, but he was also, you know, been a very important, or certainly a family friend. What's your
memory? Yeah, he was 5 years younger than my father, but they were quite close friends. And I remember Harry Holt, they called him Harry. He'd come to the front gate sometimes at our little place in Sorrento, and he'd have fish that he'd speared, which he'd bring along to Dad, because Dad needed it to bait the shark hooks. And one particular fish, which we call butterfish, I think it's a dusky morwong or something, but butterfish is what we call it. If you put one of those on a hook, you were going to get a shark straight away. They loved them. So Harry would spear those, bring them around for Dad, and sometimes come in. But he was always rushing about. And ironically, he had a place up at Bingle Bay with Zara. Mm. They lived on the cliff, which is where I ended up. I ended up getting a place only about, I don't know, 300 or 400 metres away from where their little house was. Mm. And he did a lot of spearfishing up there as well.
The political life of both sides of the maternal and paternal side of the Baillieu clan has shaped quite a few of the people within it, not least your brother Ted, who had a long career with the Victorian Liberal Party as a part of the executive, and then of course we know as premier, and was bounced out fairly brutally. Your wife Sally had a tilt at federal politics in this last federal election as running in Dunkley for the Arts Party. What's been your greatest observations of political life over a long period? You've met some pretty interesting people through that time as well.
I have. I think, gosh, where do you start? Where do you start there? We have a history of politics, in particularly on my mother's side, in the Knoxes and the MacArthurs are all cousins, and they've been involved heavily. I think William Knox was the very first member for Kooyong, which was Sir Robert Menzies' seat, and Andrew Peacock. I think Josh Frydenberg is there at the moment. Mm. His son George was Speaker in the lower house in Victoria in the 40s. Mm. Yeah, meeting interesting people like Tom Uren, Gough Whitlam, Bob Hawke. Gosh, they're all Labor politicians, aren't they? Also met Malcolm Fraser. And
We're bipartisan.
I'm going to be balanced. I have to be balanced.
Yeah.
Look, it's a brutal game, and my own feeling at looking back on it now, is I think it's an adversarial system. People talk about that, and as long as there is an adversarial system where we have one side always against the other side, it's very hard to get anything done. Mm. To actually get anything done, I often wonder how we would ever build the highways and the road network in Australia that we have if we were starting today. It just couldn't happen.
Mm.
People aren't working together enough, and I often wonder whether we shouldn't start to transform ourselves in Australia to a system where we're much more cooperative with each other and actually achieve some stuff that goes beyond the next 3 years or 6 years, when you're looking at terms like that. It's not long enough. People should be thinking 50 years in front.
Mm.
And I have to say, the whole idea of the NBN, it's had lots of opposition. People think it's going to be outdated, but I think it's a great idea. I think that is future thinking, and we need more projects like that.
Mm. It's interesting, Will Baillieu, when you think about the people that have come in and out of your life, the political people that you've met, the halls that you've walked in, and in your own life, you actually, in your own words, live a very simple life. You grow your own veggies, you run chooks, you spend an afternoon throwing around 40 cubic meters of mulch. You have a much more sustainable sort of viewpoint, a philosophy on life. How do you describe the way you live?
Well, I just think you have to live. I think at some stage you have to live. If you're not living, you've got to say, what are we here for? And living to me is having a close contact with the earth, with my friends, with family. I am a physical person, although that's becoming harder as I get older. But yeah, I'm a physical person that wants to be in touch. And also, I'm happy to stand up when I see things that aren't right. I feel a great sadness deep inside about what's happened over the last 200 years to Indigenous Australians. For me, it's a great tragedy still. And I actually feel that deep down in my heart. And I'm a great believer in, you know, in trying to fix that if we possibly can, or at least shore it up so we don't lose any more. I spent time on a community reference group that wanted to save Point Nepean when the Defence Department, the federal government, wanted to sell it off to, and they were going to sell it off to some white shoe developers from Queensland who since went broke. So I imagine it wouldn't have been a very healthy development. But we fought hard for that and we succeeded. Mm. But the rest of the time I spend living, bringing up our kids. I have older teenagers now. It's been the biggest experience, best experience of my life. It's also the hardest. Mm. But I figure that's what life's about. It's not about money and power and getting more and more. It's about actually experiencing what you've got and enjoying it.
And building a good chook shed.
Yeah.
And life on the peninsula is just the thing that sustains you.
It's just great. We have a house with that we're elevated a bit on a slope. The western sky is what does it for me. I could stand outside or sit outside at 5 o'clock every night, have a cup of coffee, and I look at that western sky with Sally and with the kids of their home, and I just am in awe every time I look out there. It's different every night, and I feel totally blessed to be able to spend the time here.
We're going to have a listen to a truncated version of a song that I know you love very much from the Dixie Hummingbirds. Jesus is coming soon, even though you say that you're not overly religious, but you love your singing and you love your gospel singing. You've been something of a singer, choir singer yourself.
Used to be in a choir, love the four-part harmony, love gospel music and blues music, and of course it's all tied together and all comes from the same place, and this is some really old guys that are no longer with us. I just love it.
Yeah. Will Bailey, thank you for being our guest on the Wordy Rapping Hood. These are the Dixie Hummingbirds. Yeah. If you enjoyed that conversation with Will Bailey, it will be up on the Ardwell PFM website, the podcast page. Go to the Wordy Rapping Hood page and you'll find it there.